You ain't heard nothing yet.
Get around, little
What am I going to do?
Frankly, my dear,
I'm going to make him an offer.
You talking to me?
Stay out of the train!
I don't know who you are.
Why so sick?
When I'm good, I'm very good.
Symbol.
But when I'm bad, I'm better.
He's a liar!
They call me Mr.
Boy's best friend is his mother.
You have no style.
You're gonna bark all day, little dog.
No more!
Everyone!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tinsel Factory. My name is Caitlin, and I'm your host. Hope everybody had a great week. Highlight of mine was seeing Taylor Swift in concert. Say what you want about her, but that woman is a born performer. There aren't many people in this world who can sing for 3.5 hours like that with that kind of schedule that she's been doing that on without a break and still not have it get tired or monotonous. And it was really fun. I enjoyed it. I didn't realize that she went on at 8:30, though, because I'm not a consummate concert goer. I didn't realize that the start time was actually when the openers start. So that was a fun surprise, because that meant we weren't leaving until like midnight, which was not my favorite because I'm old and it was a Wednesday. Anyway, no movie theater movie reviews this week because I was either at home getting ready for the concert mentally or after that recovering from the concert mentally and physically because I'm old and it was a lot. So let's just get right into the strike updates. 2 days ago, if you're listening to this on release day, the writers and the AMPTP have returned to the negotiating table. At this point, it's a waiting game for news. I don't know how much we're going to know until either a deal is struck or talks break down again, because I think they're being pretty mum on it, or at least so far they're being mum on it. I don't think there's a media blackout, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong. But yeah, no major news yet, but it also has only been one day. For SAG-AFTRA, no negotiations have been set, but I'm assuming they're going to do this one at a time just to stretch this out for as long as it can be for some reason. And now on to this week's topic. This week, we take yet another speed run through another country's film history, and this week it is Canada. What I didn't know before I started researching this over the last couple weeks is that Canada actually has a bit of a frustrating film history, and we'll cover that from its first exhibition in the late 19th century to the years of being overshadowed by the American film industry and what is currently up with the current state of Canadian cinema. With that, let's take our places. It's showtime. The first documented Canadian film screening was at an event organized by Louis Minier and Louis Poupier using the Lumière's cinematograph in Saint-Laurent, Quebec on June 27, 1896. Until 1984, however, that credit was given to another duo, and depending on the source you're working from, sometimes still are. This one happened in July 1896 when brothers George and Andrew Holland, who'd opened the first New York City Kinetoscope parlor, returned to their hometown of Ottawa to introduce Thomas Edison's Vitascope to the Canadian public. Vitascope was Edison's early projector, in case you've forgotten. Among the shorts shown at the Ottawa exhibition or event or whatever you want to call it was The Kiss, which actually starred Canadian-born actress May Irwin. August of that year saw Toronto's first public film screening, and film exhibition finally reached Vancouver in December of 1898. The first Canadian films were produced in the fall of 1897. They were made by James Freer, a Manitoba farmer, who shot film showing life on the prairies. In 1898, sponsored by the Canadian Pacific Railway, fared toward England with what, by modern standards, would be considered home movies, which are collectively known as 10 Years in Manitoba. The Canadian Railroad sponsored other filmmakers as well, having them shoot daily scenes of Canadian life and the country's western settlement into the 1930s. In 1903, Leo Ernest Ouimet established the country's first film exchange in Montreal. 3 years later, he opened the country's first permanent movie theater there, and a year later, the first luxury theater. Fiction films began to develop in the country starting in 1912, after a decade of mainly newsreels and actuals. In Halifax, the Canadian Bioscope Company made the first Canadian feature-length film, which was called Evangeline, and that released in 1913-1914, depending on the source. The film, which is now lost, dealt with the expulsion of the Acadians, which was a historical event that involved the British violently kicking out a group of French descent settlers from their homes in the mid-18th century. The film, at the time, was a financial and critical smash. In the beginning, Canadian cinema was very ahead of its time as far as like establishing infrastructure. Canada became the first country to develop a state-sponsored film organization with the founding of the Ontario Motion Picture Bureau in May 1917. The goal of the organization was to produce content to educate school-aged children, factory workers, farmers, and the like, while promoting infrastructure projects. The company would also begin producing its own content in 1923, and at its peak was sending out 1,500 reels per month. Additionally, the organization now known as the Canadian Government Motion Picture Bureau was founded in 1918. It was the first national film production unit in the world and was used to promote industry and trade within Canada. Despite all its success in production and distribution, the Bureau never attempted to develop a domestic film production industry in Canada. In fact, it actively discouraged it. The organization saw the independent Canadian film industry as an extension of the American film industry, and this distinction and decision not to foster an independent Canadian film industry still affects Canada to this day. For a few years at this point, American productions had been traveling north to use Canada's lush scenery as a backdrop and even use stereotypical Canadian villains like French lumberjacks as villains. After World War I, there was a boom in Canadian nationalism, which trickled into the Canadian film industry. The most successful Canadian producer of this period was Ernest Shipman, who had started his career as a promoter in the United States. Shipman returned to Canada in 1919 with his author-actress wife Nell to produce the romantic adventure film Back to God's Country, which released in 1919, in Calgary. The film was released worldwide and was a runaway smash. Didn't hurt that Nell appeared fully nude in the film either, and people kind of gravitated towards that. For the next several years, Shipman would establish several companies throughout Canada while adapting popular Canadian novels for the screen. After a series of modestly performing films, though never at the level of Back to God's Country, Shipman would leave the country in 1923 after the financial disaster of his film Blue Water. He'd die in obscurity in 1931. Shipman's departure from the country ended the brief boom in Canadian film production as well. To give you an illustration of that, in 1923, only two films were produced in Canada. Nine had been made the year prior. In the United States, Canadian-themed films, not films from Canada, but films about Canada, that distinction is important, were gaining popularity, which saw an uptick in American productions coming to the country to shoot their films. But when it came to Canadians proper, for the remainder of the 1920s, their productions were mostly just shooting inserts for American newsreels or doing sponsored short films for like the government organizations and also documentaries for those same organizations. And there was maybe like a handful of private film companies knocking around making the odd film here or there. The only major exception occurred in 1927 when a group of investors raised $500,000 to produce Carry On Sergeant, a silent film about Canadians during World War I. It was written and directed by British author and cartoonist Bruce Bairnsfather. Though well received by critics, it had the misfortune of coming out at the start of the sound era, and this silent film was considered a relic within weeks of its release. Also in the 1920s, the American studios began buying up Canadian theater chains as the studio system began to take shape. As a result, Canadian film revenue began to be considered a part of the American box office, as far as the studios were concerned anyway. Challenges were made against the studios doing any of this, but they all failed in court. Other countries, specifically in Europe, made quota laws to protect themselves from the tidal wave of Hollywood films being produced after World War I, but Canada's lawmakers did not put up such quotas. By the 1930s, Canada's English-speaking film industry was merely an appendage of Hollywood's. Starting in 1928, the UK enforced a law that stated that 15% of films shown on its screens had to be either British or Commonwealth in origin. If you don't know, Canada is part of the Commonwealth. To get around this sneaky little quota, from 1928 to 1937, a total of 22 low-budget feature films were produced in Canada by Canadian based, but American-financed companies who had established offices in Calgary, Toronto, and Montreal. These films are commonly referred to as quota quickies and were essentially Hollywood finding a loophole. In 1938, when the quota was up for renewal, unsurprisingly, the Commonwealth films were excluded from counting against that 15%. In Quebec, starting in the 1930s, ethnographic filmmakers emerged. They were amateur filmmakers who were most often priests, and they made 16mm films that served educational or promotional purposes. One of the first of these filmmakers was Albert Tessier, whose work is considered a major precursor to direct documentary filmmaking, which is a genre similar to fly-on-the-wall documentaries. Basically, the footage is edited to, you know, create a story, but you're not getting, like, inserts of people talking about an event. You're only seeing footage that was covered at the time. You're not breaking away. No one's really, you know, guiding a story or interjecting too much of their opinion. You're just seeing the events as they happened. That's a direct documentary. Tessier's goal in making these documentaries was to promote the beauty of nature and traditional rural life of French Canadians. Due to the era primarily speaking a different language than the rest of Canada, their film industry would develop slightly independently from the English-speaking one, and at times was actually flourishing quite more than the English-speaking cohort. One standout Canadian-ish fiction film made during this era was 1931's The Viking. The film told the story of a group of Newfoundland seal hunters, but was produced by American adventurer Varick Frissell. While the film is not fully Canadian in the background, according to film historians, it is a great example of what would become Canada's main genre output, which are docudramas. One of the most important events in Canadian film history was the establishment of the National Film Board of Canada, or NFB, which was established after the federal government commissioned Scottish filmmaker John Grierson to study how film production was doing in Canada. After his report, he was named the board's first film commissioner in October 1939. The NFB was originally created to coordinate the production of films, but when World War II started, this caused a shift toward active production. The NFB also absorbed the Government Motion Picture Bureau in 1941. By 1945, the NFB had grown into one of the world's largest film studios. So instead of financing films like they planned, they were the ones making them, if that wasn't clear earlier. More than 500 films were released during the war from them, including propaganda series Canada Carries On, which released from 1940 to 1959, and The World in Action, which was on from 1942 to 1945. This influx in films allowed many young Canadian filmmakers to be trained because there was a lot of work, so there was a lot of time for them to learn and get better and figure their shit out. The NFB would become a leading producer of documentaries, animation, and experimental films as a result of all this. These films won thousands of international awards, including about a dozen Oscars. While impressive, the American hold on the market endured. Only one English-Canadian feature film was made during the 1940s. This was Bush Pilot from 1947, and it was actually a knockoff of Hollywood-produced film Captains of the Clouds from 1942. The movie had trouble getting a distributor in Canada, and Dominion Films, the company that produced it, never made another film after it. After World War II, there was another attempt to enact a quota on American films into the country, or at the very least, the desire to establish a tariff. Some Canadian leaders also thought that Hollywood should also reinvest some of the profits they were making in Canada back into Canada. They were just kind of like taking the money and running instead of, you know, investing it back, which now a lot of countries are actually required to do. There's a certain percentage. If a film makes a certain amount of money in a country, they're kind of like obligated to spend that a percentage of that money there. I know the UK has got that, which is why a lot of major studios you'll see have British headquarters. That's why, which is a thing I've learned since working in residuals. Instead, the head of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association today in the United States, proposed what became known as the Canadian Cooperation Project, which went into effect in 1948. The Hollywood Film Collective, represented by the MPAA, so the major studios, agreed to shoot some of their films in Canada. And in those films, they were going to say super nice things about Canada to encourage people to go and see the Great White North for themselves. They also promised to show films made by the NFB in the States. Some were being shown, but it was a very small amount. They promised to increase that. All of this would be in exchange for unrestricted box office funds leaving Canada for Hollywood. And as a result of this agreement, suddenly, exhibition quota proposal, poof. A Canadian film studio that was being built in Vancouver ceased construction. The NFB, which had lobbied for fiscal restrictions on Hollywood money, bye-bye, no longer a problem to them. And guess what? Despite the deal, the distribution of NFB films in the United States, it did not increase. They didn't do anything about that. Several Hollywood films like Canadian Mounties versus Atomic Invaders from 1953 were shot and or set in Canada, but they were all, by and large, low-budget B-movies. As for the promise of American tourist dollars, well, shock horror, instead of increasing tourism to the country, Americans traveling to Canada actually decreased about 15% during the first 4 years of this agreement. The project came to an end in 1958. In Quebec after the war, there was also a period of active feature film production. The war, for obvious reasons, had caused a deficit of French language films, and some French filmmakers had gone into exile in Quebec. As a result, feature filmmaking blossomed in 1944, starting with Le Petit Chopin. I'm still bad at French. I can only do a French accent when I'm drunk, and I'm currently chugging coffee, so very sober. This film did so well that it helped create a stabler film industry in Quebec for a time, with international contacts and religious support backing them up. But despite this, even the Quebec films would struggle to secure firm footing in even the French markets, both domestically and abroad, stunting the industry before it collapsed altogether in 1954. Thanks to the economic boom in Canada following World War II, a number of small independent producers began to establish themselves, making primarily industrial films and shorts. In recognition of the budding film industry in the country, the Canadian Film Awards were established in 1949. They would become the Genie Awards in 1980, before merging with the Gemini Awards in 2012 to become the Canadian Screen Awards. The first film of the year was given to the short flick The Loon's Necklace from 1949. In 1954, a 50% capital cost allowance, or CCA, was announced for motion pictures, which, based on my Google skills and horrifically poor knowledge of international tax laws, I believe this is the equivalency of like a tax write-off in the States. But anyway, this CCA was introduced by the federal government in Canada to encourage private investment in Canadian film companies. As a result, about a half dozen English language films were made in the country during the late 1950s. Quebec kind of always took it in the shorts. I think that's the saying. They always just... Is take it in the shorts a euphemism for getting kicked in the crotch? I did not take my Adderall today, guys. I'm sorry. But yeah, they were always kind of like the forgotten redheaded stepchild black sheep of Canadian film, which is, you know, sucks. Anyway, back on topic. A writer for the CBC, which is the Canadian's like broadcast channel, it's like the BBC for the UK, named Sidney Fury, directed two popular and promising low-budget films in Canada about rebellious youth, called A Dangerous Age from 1957 and A Cool Sound from Hell from 1959. While popular nearly everywhere they were shown, they were widely ignored in Canada. This frustration led to Fury emigrating to the UK in 1960. He would later tell the British press, quote, I wanted to start a Canadian film industry, but nobody cared. Fury was just one of many Canadian filmmakers who would leave the country to try their hand in other larger markets. And that practice is still very much around today. While the development of feature filmmaking in Canada was refusing to take off, the opposite problem was happening over at the NFB with their short films. By the late 1950s, NFB filmmaker Norman McLaren had won 8 Canadian Film Awards, 2 major prizes at the Berlin Film Festival, and an Academy Award for his short film Neighbors from 1952. The board's Unit B was also putting out work of consistent quality when it came to documentaries. This practice continued into the 1960s. The NFB would produce 2 English-language features in the early 1960s that were kind of a sign of things to come. These were Drylanders and Nobody Wave Goodbye from 1964. The latter of these 2 films was meant to be a short docudrama, but was expanded into a feature. Panned by Canadian critics upon its initial release, it gained new life when it received rave reviews at the New York Film Festival. The late 50s and early 60s also saw the rise of cinema in Quebec once more. Emboldened by the creation of a French production branch at the NFB and the relocation of the NFB from Ottawa to Montreal, the province saw a boom in television production and technological innovations being made to production equipment allowed a new generation of filmmakers to emerge. Feature films began to release once more, like Les Chats dans les Sacs from 1964, that critics and filmmakers alike enjoyed, as they were among the first to show the Quebecois experience. On the independent side, the 60s started with minimal change. On a positive note, 1961's The Mask became the first Canadian film to be picked up for U.S. distribution. The horror film was even released in 3D. Picked up by a major studio, I should say. It wasn't the first that was distributed down there. F.R. Budge Crawley was one of a group of producers that was about to change the fortune of Canadian filmmaking, starting with René Bonnier's Amanita Pestilence from 1963. It was also the first Canadian feature film shot in color and the first to be shot simultaneously in English and also French. Despite this, it never saw a theatrical release in its own country. The advances made by the French New Wave across the pond had led to a more personal lens cinema all over the world. This happened to occur as cheap 16mm cameras were being produced, which allowed wider access to film equipment. As a result, Canada saw a surge of low-budget features produced across the country, particularly on college campuses. A popular example of this is The Bitter Ash from 1963, which was the first film made by Larry Kent while he was studying theater at the University of British Columbia. It's certainly the most controversial example of all of these college campus films because of its graphic sex scenes. Probably the biggest name to come out of this generation of new filmmakers was David Cronenberg. Inspired by his University of Toronto classmate David Sechter, who'd made his own shorts like 1965's Winter Kept Us Warm, Cronenberg made 2 experimental short films, Transfer from 1966 and From the Drain from 1967, while still in college. By 1967, it was clear that a viable Canadian film market was emerging once more, and the filmmakers looked to the government to hopefully protect their interests and find a way for their films to be seen within their own country. This time, the federal government took a significant step towards investing in a domestic industry by establishing the Canadian Film Development Corporation. The CFDC would, however, only focus on getting films produced and funded. It did not guarantee distribution at the theaters because they were still mostly held by American companies. Spoiler alert, they still are. The CFDC started off by funding several of the filmmakers on the college campuses. Many of the subsequent films were artistic in execution, but commercial failures overall, which sounds like most student films I've seen even now. Very, very arty, very little anything there for like your grandma from the Midwest. A few American-esque productions were also financed, but those also kind of failed to find an audience. After several well-received documentaries, Toronto filmmaker Don Shabib directed the docudrama Going Down the Road from 1970 with CFDC money, which was an all-around success. There were some successes. It received national and international distribution and attracted large audiences, and to this day is considered one of the best Canadian films ever produced. These CFDC films were all quote-unquote unmistakably Canadian, using regional landscapes and characters. The CFDC also funded the first Canadian fiction feature made by a woman in Sylvia Springs' Madeline Is from 1971. Most of the films from this era were made on modest budgets with CFDC money, but only a few enjoyed even modest commercial success. The CFDC was pressured to raise the visibility of the films it was funding, whether it be through securing places for the films to be seen or importing non-Canadian talent to entice Canadian audiences to want to see them. It was clear that at least a basic film industry had been established. That was obvious to them. But now they needed to find audiences to actually go sit in these theaters and watch these films and pay to watch these films so they actually had money to make more films. Once again, a call for quotas was made. In 1973, a group calling itself the Council of Canadian Filmmakers petitioned the Ontario government to enforce quotas. Instead, in 1975, the Secretary of State negotiated a voluntary quota agreement with the two largest theater chains. The chains were to guarantee, if they could please, a minimum of 4 weeks per theater per year to Canadian films and invest a minimum of $1.7 million in their production. This was never enforced in any meaningful way. It was actually a voluntary thing, which is a joke. And within 2 years, it had just faded away. What the Canadian government did do in 1974 was increase the capital cost allowance, the CCA, to 100%. This created a tax shelter that allowed investors to deduct their taxable income 100% of their investment in Canadian feature films. This resulted in a massive increase in Canadian production and marked the beginning of what is known as the tax shelter era. For a film to qualify for this write-off, the film had to be at least 75 minutes long. At least one producer and two-thirds of the above-the-line creative team, so that's your directors, your writers, your actors, and your high-ranking producers, your EPs, and your producers, had to be Canadian. At least 75% of the production and post-production services had to be completed in Canada. But since American control of Canada's movie theaters made it nearly impossible for Canadian films to profit domestically, the Canadian film industry would focus instead on producing these commercial films for export. So they were just very generic, so they would appeal to a wider audience. So they weren't really like Canadian vibed. They were just very, they basically just kind of feel like cheap American films. That's why it's really hard to kind of pick them out, because they all just kind of seem like American B-movies from this era. As a result, national film priorities shifted from low-budget cultural films to bigger-budget, more commercial projects. I should trust that I have already written this stuff down instead of going off the cuff. This policy shift came under scrutiny after critic Robert Fulford wrote a scathing review of David Cronenberg's CFDC-funded horror film Shivers. In the review titled, "You Should Know How Bad This Film Is, After All, You Paid For It," Fulford declared, quote, "If using public money to produce films like this is the only way that English Canada can have a film industry, then perhaps English Canada should not have a film industry." The review had wide backlash and sparked a furious debate in the House of Commons over the use of taxpayer dollars to fund certain types of films. The backlash was so strong that Cronenberg was reportedly evicted from his apartment due to the bad publicity. For whatever it's worth, Cronenberg had managed to sell the film to 52 countries before it even came out, recouping the film's cost before ever being shown in a single theater. So basically, anything they got in box office dollars was just a bonus. He'd already had the film break even. And this was a rarity for CFDC films at the time. So it's kind of like, you're making a pretty cray-cray horror film. Like, all of Cronenberg's films are a little bit unhinged, but you're making money, so it's like, you know, you're kind of killing. Was it Rob Peter to pay Paul? I'm very into the metaphors and similes today, apparently. Also very sassy today. I was sassy last week, wasn't I? It's been a sassy couple of weeks. Meanwhile, the beginning of this so-called tax shelter period saw the success of two films which did have high quality and solid Canadian roots. They were Ted Kotcheff's The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz from 1974 and Jan Kadar's Lies My Father Told Me from 1975. Both films were commercial hits and received Oscar nominations for their screenplays. But the quality of these films proved to be the exception during this period and not the rule. Even most of the international co-productions that were partially funded through CFDC money were just strings of artistic and financial disappointment. Not all was lost from this tax shelter era. The increase in production allowed the ability for craftspeople to regularly develop their skills. They got a lot better at doing the things. And for the first time in the industry's history, a series of producers emerged as the closest thing the country had ever had to movie moguls. This included Harold Greenberg, who produced the Porky's films, and Darth Drabinsky, who produced The Silent Partner from 1978, amongst several others. And of course, David Cronenberg would credit his films made during this era, which ended with 1981's Scanners, as the launch of his career. But all you really need to know how well this era went is that the film Porky's from 1981, you know, the film that famously has a teenage boy looking through a peephole at a naked woman in the shower on the poster, yet that film was the highest grossing Canadian film for decades. When you disregard all of that, on paper, it would have looked like this was a successful venture. 77 feature films were produced in Canada in 1979 versus only 3 5 years prior. These numbers begin to fall apart, though, once you become aware of the fact that most of these films never got theatrical releases in the country they were made in, and most of them were indistinguishable from crappy American films. Did you know Porky's was Canadian before today? I didn't. Well, I did because I wrote this, but you know what I mean. But as a whole, this era was seen as a failure. In 1982, the CCA was reduced to 50%, and the tax shelter era came to an end. By this point, only 3% of feature films produced in Canada from 1978 to 1981 were in French. Efforts to change this occurred in 1981 when the Parti Québécois came to power. Their goal, in part, was the preservation of Québécois culture, particularly through the preservation of their French roots and their language. In December 1982, Bill 109 was introduced, which was a bombshell when it came to film distribution. In addition to creating several new regulatory bodies, the bill would require distribution companies in Quebec to be at least 80% Canadian-owned. Distributors and exhibitors were also required to contribute a percentage of their profits to a production fund. The bill was unanimously approved in June of 1983, but the ratification process was protested and delayed at every opportunity by the Motion Picture Association of America, which was the MPAA, if you forgot. This bill was never ratified, so it was never enforced. And in October 1986, a year after the Parti Québécois fell out of majority, the Canadian Prime Minister of Cultural Affairs signed an agreement with the MPAA that actually strengthened and legalized Hollywood's hold over the province. So basically just completely shat on that plan. So after all of this, in the early to mid-1980s, the film industry in Canada was once more on shaky ground. It was almost entirely dependent upon government financing, yet was unable to consistently secure screens in its own theaters. In 1984, the CFDC was transformed into Telefilm Canada and given a $35 million broadcast program development fund. This reflected its new dual orientation, which was funding television programs as well as theatrical films. And while we've been talking a lot about like the background stuff, films were, I promise, being made. This included Adam Egoyan's The Sweet Hereafter from 1997, which was nominated for Academy Awards for Adapted Screenplay and Best Director, the latter of which was a first for any Canadian director. In the mid-1990s, funding cuts at all levels of government began to take their toll, and this included Telefilm Canada. But by 2001, a new $100 million a year fund was established, and one of the goals of the fund was to increase the presence of Canadian films in its theaters from about 2%, which it was at the time, to 5% within 5 years. The films produced out of this fund were a series of just okay generic films that were made in the hopes of attracting a wider audience. This included Men with Brooms from 2002 and Mambo Italiano from 2003. Have you heard of either of those? No, me neither. They produced those, but My Big Fat Greek Wedding from 2002, a film that was shot in Toronto, was written by and starred a Canadian actress named Nia Vardalos, was denied funding by Telefilm. They would not give her money to make her film, so she went and got it elsewhere. It went on to gross more than $240 million at the box office. It was one of the biggest, I believe it was the biggest independent film for quite a while there as far as making money goes. So that was a pretty big oops on Telefilm's part. In 2005, Telefilm reported that domestic films made up over 21% of the Quebec market. That's a pretty good chunk of your film market. However, English-Canadian films were at 1.6%. This was just a slight fraction higher than 80 years prior when there basically was no film industry. Once again that year, legislators attempted to change the way the government supported Canadian films. They recommended that theaters be forced to devote more screen time to Canadian movies and that television broadcasters be required to air Canadian films and their advertisements. Nothing changed. Despite the failure of the box office mandates for the millionth time, something was shifting with the Canadian filmmakers. Many of them began producing movies with broader commercial appeal that also managed to maintain a sense of the Canadian identity. This included FUBAR from 2002, Goon from 2010, and What If from 2013. Quebec continued its string of box office successes. They were just kind of like the silent killers throughout all of this, with Charles Bénamé's biopic The Rocket from 2005 and Eric Canwell's Bon Cop, Bad Cop from 2006. Bon Cop, Bad Cop would become the highest grossing Canadian film domestically with a take of $12 million. The cult comedy Trailer Park Boys, the movie from 2006, scored a rare success within English Canada. It opened on more than 200 screens and grossed $1.3 million on its opening weekend. Yes, these numbers feel small when you look at American box offices, but this was huge for Canadian screens. Actress Sarah Pauley made her directorial debut with the Oscar-nominated Away From Her in 2006. Most recently, she co-wrote and directed the 2022 film Women Talking, which was nominated for several awards, including Best Picture at the Academy Awards. Pauley won the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for that film. So, production of high-performing cinema in Canada does exist and has been more or less stable in Canada for the last 20, 25 years or so, and has even become a multi-billion dollar business. Today, many American film and television productions are shot within the country, taking advantage of the tax breaks and generally lower cost of producing within the country. So the American hold on Canadian film industries as a whole, still very strong. While distribution of Canadian films is still a very active problem, things are better than they were. And currently, Toronto is the biggest market in the world for English language Canadian films. In addition to David Cronenberg, other famous directors to come out of Canada in the last 30, 40 years, like I said, are Adam Egoyana, who I mentioned earlier. He has enjoyed a Hollywood career with films like Dallas Buyers Club from 2013. There's also Denis Villeneuve, I can never say his last name, who has become popular for making sci-fi films in the States, like 2021's Dune. He did Arrival. He did Prisoners, which isn't a sci-fi movie, but is terrific if you've not seen it, but that is an American-produced film. And before leaving, Villeneuve made films like 2000's Maelstrom and 2010's Incendies. Today, Canada enjoys a thriving domestic industry in Quebec, while the English-Canadian films remain a bit shaky. Government money continues to be crucial for both markets' success, but the Canadian people still have a weak relationship with their own films. So what are you doing, Canadians? At least 2% of you are Canadian based on my listener metrics. Go watch some of your own films. Actually, all of you, go find a Canadian film and watch it. That's your homework. Find yourself a fun Canadian film. They're out there. They exist. I just listed a whole bunch of them. Go and do that.
Thank you.
And that's going to do it for this week. If you'd like me to cover something in the future, please reach out on social media, where I also post photos for each episode. At Tinsel Factory Pod on Instagram, on Facebook at The Tinsel Factory, or you can always email me at tinselfactorypod@gmail.com. I've got a Letterboxd account, which features my watch lists, film diary, and recommended viewing for this episode. You can check it out at the link in the show notes. I'm relying on word of mouth to get this podcast out there, so if you could please rate, review, and subscribe so that other people can find this podcast, that would be a huge help. In order to keep making the podcast, I've also set up a support page, the link of which you can find in the show notes. If you'd like to help out in any way, I'd very much appreciate it. I've got the Buy Me a Coffee, where you buy me a coffee. I am chugging Phil's like it's my job, and I was a lazy ass and had it delivered to my house, but it is very good and I'm very happy. I've also got merch. Check it out at the link in the show notes. Next week, we are taking a dive into the history of Brazilian cinema. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, that's a wrap.